please learn more about Freedomizer Radio by going to freedomizerradio.com and also Facebook us right at freedomizerradio.com. Catch you there.
Call in our live number at 319-527-6208. That's 319-527-6208. Press 1 to participate on the air.
Did you know that every time you swipe your debit card, those behind-the-scenes transaction fees make the big banks even richer? In 2016 alone, these fees added up to $60 billion. Yes, that's billion with a B. Well, what if there was a way to have the convenience of a debit card, but reroute those fees from the banksters to organizations actually doing good in the world? Organizations that protect the environment or feed hungry children? What if your swipes could literally change the world? Well, Groundswell SPC has found a way to do just that. We've designed a Visa debit card program that shares transaction fees with your favorite cause. Groundswell partners with nonprofit organizations that promote the card to their supporters. Their supporters then use the card to power the mission of the nonprofit. It's a win-win-win for everyone, except the big banks, of course. Groundswell is about to launch its first cards into market, and we're inviting you to be part of this movement as an investor in the company. Go to wefunder.com/groundswellcard to learn more. Set up a free WeFunder account and invest in Groundswell today and get your money on mission.
Good evening and welcome to another exciting edition of Ancient of Days on this Easter Sunday, coming to you live from beautiful downtown Crestline in the San Bernardino Mountains of Southern California's Inland Empire on April 21 in the year of our Lord 2019, Easter Sunday. Now, I completely forgot that it was Easter a week ago when I scheduled this podcast and did my started doing show prep and coming up with things to talk about. So, I'm not really prepared to talk about Easter except to say that it is the day when He is risen. So rise up, all of you. Find joy in your hearts. If you're feeling down, stand up and shout for joy. Laugh, smile. If nothing else, thank the Lord for the sunshine and for the rain, for clouds and clear skies, and for anything that this world throws at you. If it's good, it brings joy. If it hurts, it makes you stronger. So shout for joy that He is risen. And remember, faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things unseen. Well, that's my Easter speech, and I took it from Paul, and I think that's in one of the Corinthians. Well, okay, I'll look that up. Faith is the substance of things. That ought to be enough. Yes. Oh, sorry, it's in Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 1. Okay, well, let's get the King James Version because I like the beauty of that poetry. The language of the King James is awesome. And here it says, Now, faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. And let's see if we can get the following verses. Come on, evil computer, load it. It's slower than slow. Ah, verse 2, for by it, that is faith, for by it the elders obtained a good report. Through faith we understand that the worlds were framed by the word of God, so that things which are not, so that things which are seen were not made of things which do appear. And so on, and so forth. By faith our forefathers offered prayers and sacrifices to God. Now, let's get with what I did plan for this evening. Things I'm reading and things I'm writing. I wanted to start with William Faulkner's book, The Sound and the Fury, but guess what? I can't find it, and it is not available free online. You have to buy the book, and I already did that, and I just don't know where I put it. So I'll just talk about that book, unless this is it, hiding behind a box of Kleenex. I can't see the light's wrong. Let's grab a flashlight and shine some light on this. Nope, not it. Okay. Well, I love William Faulkner's book, The Sound and the Fury, but then I'm weird. If normal people want to read it, you know, or people who just aren't quite as weird as I am, you need to know a few things before you start. It's all told in internal monologue, the thoughts and words of the people, the characters in the novel. And it begins with Benji, who is a child in an adult body. He's autistic and does not understand things. So he's talking about hitting. And if you can get through that for a while, you'll learn that he's watching men play golf on a golf course. They're hitting the balls with their clubs. Now, that golf course used to be the pasture where Benji kept his pony. It's Benji's pasture. But the family had to sell it to pay the bills and keep their home. So Benji is standing at the fence looking out at what used to be his pasture where he used to keep his pony, and he's watching men play golf. Now, The Sound and the Fury is a great title, and it is not exactly original with Faulkner. It comes from the Shakespeare play, Macbeth, Act 5, Scene 5. After Macbeth finds that his wife is dead, she's killed herself. And Macbeth says, "Out, out, brief candle. Life's but a walking shadow, a poor play that struts and frets his hour upon the stage and then is heard no more. It is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing." And this first section, quite a long section of The Sound and the Fury, is quite literally a tale told by an idiot. Benji is the literal definition of idiot, which means that he's so self centered that he has no contact with the world. He's autistic. He doesn't understand other people. And Faulkner goes on to confuse you terribly with two characters named Quentin. One, Quentin is a boy, it has to be three brothers, one of Benji's two brothers who are sort of normal, sort of, but they're all damaged people. And the other Quentin is a child, a girl named Quentin, because, and this is a big secret that comes out when, what's her name? Quentin's mother tells her story. I've forgotten her name, but she has this daughter named Quentin because the father of her child is her brother Quentin. This family screwed up, and somehow that doesn't bother me. It's a fascinating story. I will be talking in a while about some things that I'm writing, but first, I came across a copy of The Wind in the Willows at a yard sale of all places. Little paperback. You know, Mr. Toad and the Muskrat, and it came to my, and Mole and Little Critters on a Boat in the River. It came to my attention, and I realized that I never had read the book. I've been on Mr. Toad's Wild Ride at Disneyland in Anaheim. I've seen cartoons, but I had never, ever read this book by Kenneth Graham, G-R-A-H-A-M-E, The Wind in the Willows. So I'm going to read a little bit from Toad's Adventures. 147, I think, is what I want. I want to see him driving a car. Oh, well. Oh, it's a library discard. Horrors. Toad's Adventures, page 112. That might be it. Whatever I come to, I'll just read it. Here we go. Chapter 8, Toad's Adventures. When Toad found himself immured in a dank and noisome dungeon, and knew that all the grim darkness of a medieval fortress lay between him and the outer world of sunshine and well-metalled high roads where he had lately been so happy, disporting himself as if he had bought up every road in England, he flung himself at full length on the floor and shed bitter tears and abandoned himself to dark despair. I believe this is where the weasels locked him up so they could steal his stuff. Back to the book. This is the end of everything, he said. At least it is the end of the career of Toad, which is the same thing. The popular and handsome Toad, the rich and hospitable Toad, the Toad so free and careless and debonair. How can I hope to be ever set at large again, he said, who have been imprisoned so justly for stealing so handsome a motor car in such an audacious manner and for such lurid and imaginative cheek, bestowed upon such a number of fat, red-faced policemen. Here his sobs choked him. "Stupid animal that I was," he said. "Now I must languish in this dungeon till people who were proud to say they knew me have forgotten the very name of Toad. Oh, wise old badger," he said. "Oh, clever, intelligent rat and sensible mole." So this is after his wild ride in the car. I'm going to skip down, and he's in jail. Let's skip to the part where it says, "Now the jailer," G-A-O-L-E-R, jailer, it's British, remember, "had a daughter, a pleasant wench and good-hearted, who assisted her father in the lighter duties of his post. She was particularly fond of animals, and besides her canary, whose cage hung on a nail in the massive wall of the keep by day, to the great annoyance of prisoners who relished an after-dinner nap, and was shrouded in an antimacassar on the parlor table at night." I'll tell you what an antimacassar is. Back in the day, I'd say the 20s and the 30s, men used to slick down their hair with macassar oil. And women would tat this lacy stuff called a anti-macassar to put on the arms and backs of the chairs and the couches, the sofas, to keep the oil off. Okay, so besides her canary, she kept several piebald mice and a restless revolving toad. A restless revolving squirrel. Sorry, skipped a line. This kind-hearted girl, pitying the misery of Toad, said to her father one day, "Father, I can't bear to see that poor beast so unhappy and getting so thin. You let me have the managing of him. You know how fond of animals I am. I'll make him eat from my hand and sit up and do all sorts of things." Her father replied that she could do what she liked with him. He was tired of Toad and his sulks and his airs and his meanness. So that day she went on her errand of mercy and knocked at the door of Toad's cell. "Now cheer up, Toad," she said coaxingly on entering, "and sit up and dry your eyes and be a sensible animal. And do try and eat a bit of dinner. See, I've brought you some of mine, hot from the oven." It was bubble and squeak between two plates, and its fragrance filled the narrow cell. The penetrating smell of cabbage reached the nose of Toad as he lay prostrate in his misery on the floor, and gave him the idea for a moment that perhaps life was not such a blank and desperate thing as he had imagined. And this goes on and on. And skipping quite a bit. "Tell me about Toad Hall," said she. "It sounds beautiful." "Toad Hall," said the toad proudly, "is an eligible, self-contained gentleman's residence, very unique, dating in part from the 14th century, but replete with every modern convenience. Up-to-date sanitation, 5 minutes from church, post office, and golf links, suitable for..." And he breaks off. "Bless the animal," said the girl, laughing. "I don't want to take it. Tell me something real about it. But first wait till I fetch you some more tea and toast." And it goes on and on, but eventually Toad is allowed to leave. And so I haven't quite finished the book yet, but I can say that I've read a good two-thirds of it. And then I never understood why Ray Bradbury, an author of wonderful science fiction, including The Martian Chronicles and Dandelion Wine, which is not really science fiction, but really great short stories in a book. At least that's how I remember it. I had no idea why he was so obsessed with Moby Dick, because I never was that much into science fiction. I just kind of fell into it when I met Philip K. Dick and married him. Well, here's another book that I picked up more recently, so I haven't read the bulk of it, but I've read enough to understand that he wrote the screenplay for the movie Moby Dick, because that's what this book is about. It's called Green Shadows, White Whale. And let's read from the back. It's 1953, and a young writer is summoned to Ireland by the brilliant, egotistical film director John Huston. His assignment: to catch a leviathan on the nib of his silver pen by writing a screenplay for that whale of a novel, Moby Dick. But from the moment he steps off the boat and onto the shimmering green isle, he finds himself embarked on an adventure even more extraordinary and far more impossible to penetrate, the enigma of this fog-shrouded land and its maddening and wonderful people. Here are sentimental IRA terrorists, lovelorn banshees, tippling priests, and devilish playwrights, and through it all, the indefatigable good cheer of the boyos at Heber Finn's pub. Green Shadows, White Whale is a masterful tale told as only Ray Bradbury can tell it, capturing for all time a land where magic is commonplace, poetry is the native tongue, and life is a tragedy that somehow always leaves us laughing in the end. Wow. Let's see. Where was I? I've lost my bookmarks, and I don't generally write in my books. I used to do a lot of highlighting when I was in college, but I'm not in college now. I see in the chat room, Hiram Abiff says Chinese use willows to contact entities / spirits. Well, okay. Let's see. This is not where I wanted to read. I must have turned a page too many. There's a problem with a wedding, but it's being sorted or not. That's how things happen in Ireland, according to Bradbury. All was in readiness. The stale wedding cake, growing more ancient by the hour, awaited. The tooth-aching and tongue-blistering champagne was laid by. The horses were steaming the air and smiling derisive smiles in the courtyard. The hounds were padding in circles, wetting bricks, hooves, and boots. The lords and ladies and the owners of liquor shops all across Ayr had arrived, of course, and dismounted to the nibbling smiles of horses and the suspicious protests of the hounds. "Stirrup cups for all," someone cried. "That's before we ride," a lady corrected, "and it's just for the groom." What I meant to say is the bar open? There is no bar, announced the Reverend Mr. Hicks, standing so straight and correct it was obvious he had just been there. But there is champagne, good silver buckets and bad. Beware of the shilling poison up front. Demand the pound sterling mums. In other words, don't drink the lousy wine, drink the good stuff. The horses were quickly abandoned and the hounds left to harass the kennel master and water the yard. The guests booted up the steps, making hollow clubbing sounds on the concrete, their faces distorted not by funhouse mirrors but by ancestry alone. Time and the patient chromosome had worked their clay, bucking the teeth, rooming the eye, that's R-H-E-U-M, grooming, elongating the lip, beaking the nose, cleaving the chin. Sorry about that. Hollowing the cheek, jugging the ears, eroding the hair, tufting the eyebrows, bleaching the eyelids, waxing the complexion, pocking the brow, and knobbing the elbows, wrists, and fingers. Some looked as if they had stood too many years inside and looking out from stable doors. My God, I thought, what a jumbled sale of skulls and ears, lower lips and high-flung eyebrows. Here danced the spider, there thundered the hippo, here the spaniel eyes wet itself with Irish sunlight, there the hound mouth drooped into despairs of days when no sun rose. Not quite crayfish. A fiddle crab liquor salesman sidled up the steps, bringing with him the eyes of Adonis locked in a face so crimson he might have parboiled himself for breakfast. Here they all came in pink or black coats with bloated brows, insect nostrils, and wharf-piling jaws. I reeled back and drifted with the clamor of boots, to see elbows shoving about in the rummage for mums as against 12 trees bubbly. Well, yes, that's very poetic, but I can't read you the whole book. It's copyrighted. Same with Faulkner, same with The Wind in the Willows. Okay, let's check the time. We're good. We're very good. I'm also going to talk about some of the things that I'm writing. I'm working on a sequel to my murder mystery. I've been working on it for several years and just keep getting distracted by the vicissitudes of life, like paying bills and such. It takes time and work to write. It isn't easy. Well, anyway, in the first one, Murder Lies, a phony psychic agrees to do a favor for an old college friend. He does have a private investigator's license because in order to be a phony psychic, she does have to do some detective work. A look into the background of her clients and find out things she can tell them to convince them that she's for real. Well, anyway, she has her offices in San Bernardino in Southern California, and she agrees to fly to Denver to help her old college friend solve a mystery about one of his employees. And about employee theft. After she arrives in Denver, a murder occurs. And she solves it. and comes back home to the San Bernardino Mountains, where she lives in Twin Peaks with her cat. Oh, and Lavinia Stout, my detective lady, soon finds herself embroiled in another problem. There's a murder, and the body is laid on her doorstep. Almost literally, it's in the driveway, lying in the snow. And at first, she's the prime suspect, but she points the finger at someone else. Now, in the sequel, Murder Bleeds, yes, as in blood, there will be vampires. And then Lavinia will begin to suspect that she really is a little bit psychic. Maybe. Anyway, she has decided to quit being a phony psychic and become a real detective. That's my murder mystery. Now, of course, eventually this afternoon I will talk about the ex in exegesis. My late ex-husband, Philip K. Dick, is known for The Man in the High Castle, Blade Runner, Electric Dreams, Minority Report, Total Recall, and much, much more. His work inspired The Matrix. Inspired means they didn't pay for the rights. Anyway, I don't care. I don't get any money from his work anyway. I never should have signed the divorce papers, but how did I know he was going to die? And it just seemed the right thing to do since he left me for another woman. I thought he should be free to marry her if he chose to do so. He never did choose to do so. He kept bugging me to take him back. So I finally said yes, and within a couple months he was dead, and we never remarried. Well, anyway, exegesis is his 10,000-plus page series of notes, which he never intended to publish as they were. Those were his notes for something he planned to write for publication. Details what he interpreted as a religious experience. I tend to believe some of it. But remember, he was a writer of fiction, and he did exaggerate and embellish. He also did tons of research. But what he and I could not know at the time was how the electronic equipment in the vacant apartment next door to us played into his experience. We didn't know about the CIA's Voice of God technology, which they claim they used in Iraq to tell the Iraqi soldiers to lay down their weapons and surrender. Well, sorry about the coughing. It happens every time I'm on the air. I'll be okay all day till I start my show, and then boom. We'll get into that after our very first commercial break. And don't go away. We will be back in a flash. Let's see, here we go.
Hello, everyone. I'd like to talk to you about our newest sponsor, Misty'sGardens.com. Now, this is a contraption where you can grow food in your apartment, in a small patio, or if you're like me and you absolutely suck at gardening, this makes life a lot easier. It is a vertical tower garden. We can grow over 20 things at once in a small, compacted area. Good health starts with good habits, like eating wholesome foods. And with tower gardens, you can easily grow your own fresh, nutrient-rich food virtually anywhere year-round without soil. So Misty'sGardens.com, have a look at it, check it out, buy it, plant, and like it. Misty'sGardens.com.
Imagine standing barefoot on cushy grass while you use a professional-grade knife to deftly chop fresh vegetables on your organic bamboo cutting board. The team at MyZestiness.com wants to help your family enjoy home cooking like this more often. They do this by offering fun and functional tools that make your time in the kitchen more efficient and enjoyable. MyZestiness.com offers the finest and most interesting kitchen goods and accessories, all backed by their world-class customer service team. Check out their ever-expanding inventory today. Visit MyZestiness.com. That's zesty like spicy, nest like home. MyZestiness.com. In this digital society, making connections is quickly becoming a lost art form. Yet, if you are a small business owner, building your network is the only way you can get ahead. Can these skills be learned? You bet they can. Read Nose to Nose Networking, No Nonsense In-Person Networking Tips from a Master. Who's the master? Well, who better to teach networking and friend-building skills than a golden retriever? The author, Melanie Hope, takes the antics of Abigail and translates them into the human experience. Through Abby, you will learn how to set your intention, build a network, and get into and out of conversations with grace. If you love the Dog Abby segments on Counterculture Wise Radio, you will love Nose to Nose Networking even more. Find it on Amazon and Barnes & Noble in hard copy, Kindle, and Nook. Visit CounterCultureWise.com for direct links.
And please remember that the author, Melanie Hope, is also the host of CounterCultureWise, the show which comes on this evening at 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern, usually on Freedom Miser Radio, but our website has crashed, so it's on Blog Talk Radio. So if you don't have a link, you can go to Blog Talk Radio and search for Freedom Miser Radio, and because we're a network with a lot of shows, and you'll find that Counterculture Wise comes on at 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern. And yes, we're getting a new website, a new host for our website. The one we've got is just too glitchy. It keeps crashing. So, anyway, for this week and possibly next week, we'll still be on blogtalkradio.com. And let's see. The X in exegesis. Well, first of all, looking back and knowing things that I've learned quite recently, I am certain that Philip K. Dick, the science fiction author, my husband at the time, I'm certain that he and I were attacked by some kind of electronic equipment. And at the time, even though Phil thought it was directed at him, I was not so sure. I am now. The vacant apartment next door was filled with all kinds of electronic equipment. We knew that because we're nosy, we're curious, and the apartment next door was unlocked. The door opened, and we saw all this stuff. And for the longest time, I thought that the landlord was spying on his wife, but actually, they had tapped our phone. And at the time, I thought, well, they just didn't know how to hook up the tap on their own, on their home phone, where the landlord wanted to see if his wife was cheating on him. We had all kinds of problems with our phone, and so we had the phone company come out, and they said that an illegal line had been connected to our phone, and the telephone company worker disconnected that illegal line, and we no longer had problems with our phone. So anyway, also there was a working telephone in the vacant apartment, and when I picked it up out of curiosity, I could hear people talking. It just seemed like normal conversation, but that's what led me to believe that our landlord was spying on his wife and getting ready for a divorce. There was a tape recorder in the hall closet. There was all kinds of electronic equipment. But we began to see, now Phil saw details that he could describe. I just caught glimpses out of the corner of my eye of figures, people, strange looking people that you could see right through. They were almost transparent. And he heard them talking to him, but he said their mouths were not moving, so he thought they were thinking to him. And this did seem to be specifically directed at Phil. And whatever I experienced was just kind of collateral damage. And at one point, our bedside radio was telling Phil to die, to kill himself. I didn't hear that. I just heard it playing soft, popular music. But Phil asked me to turn it off, and I did, but it kept playing. So I unplugged it, and it still kept playing. That radio was probably hit by microwave radiation or a strong radio signal. That can happen. It didn't have batteries. It was strictly plugged into the wall. But a strong electromagnetic field can turn on a radio, even a television. Many appliances will turn on when there's a strong electromagnetic field. So anyway, we shoved the radio into the hall closet. We just did not like having it act so weird. But Phil was harassed. We both developed insomnia and suffered nightmares. Until finally something else came along. A woman's voice telling Phil that he was good, that he deserved to live, and that he had a purpose in life. And that led to the beginning of what he called exegesis. It led to the first Valis novel, that's V-A-L-I-S, which stands for Vast Active Living Intelligence System. I always thought he should have made it intelligent, ending with a T rather than C-E, intelligence. But in a sense, it is a spy network, a good, benevolent spy network. And the first Valis novel was originally titled Valis. And Phil's agent returned it, saying that no publisher would take it on, that it was not marketable. So it sat on the shelf for decades. Phil wrote another novel titled Valis, different novel, which eventually was published, primarily because publishers thought that when the movie Blade Runner was made, based on one of Phil's novels, they would be able to sell anything that Phil wrote. And eventually they also published, in addition to Valis, The Transmigration of Timothy Archer and Divine Invasions. And those three came to be known as the Valis Trilogy. But The Transmigration of Timothy Archer does not belong in that series. It's more of a counterpoint, an opposite to his earlier 1960s novel, The Three Stigmata of Palmer Eldritch. No, the third novel in the trilogy should be, wait for it, his first Valis novel, which is now titled, Phil himself crossed out Valis and wrote the new title, but it took the people running his estate a long, long time, years and years, to realize that. And that novel is Radio Free Albemuth, A-L-B-E-M, as in Mary, U-T-H. Albemuth is a star, and I keep forgetting which constellation it's in. So let's look that up. My memory is not as good as it used to be. The past is very clear in my mind, but recent events kind of... well, it's giving me as the novel. I want the star and the constellation. Come on, guys. Albemuth means whale's mouth. Okay. That's what it is. Phil kind of made it up. It's Fomalhaut. Albemuth. There's no definitions, but Phil always said it meant whale's mouth, and I come up with Fomalhaut. And I think that does mean whale's mouth. Fomal, Fomalhaut. It's in Pisces. Piscis Austrinus. That's not the zodiac sign Pisces. Fomalhaut. Okay. And let's see, Fomalhaut mythology? Really? Let's see. Well, anyway, Radio Free Albemuth. is the original Vallis novel, and it got its name from Arabic for the mouth of the fish. I could have sworn that I should use the term translate. Alba Mus is kind of a misspelling. Let's see. In Zulu, it means Elba tree. But I think Phil was trying to say whale's mouth or white mouth. He was trying to spell mouth in German, which is, let me see. I should know without looking it up, but yeah, mouth is Mund, M-U-N-D in German. And he read a lot of poetry, so he might have picked up an obsolete form. Yeah. Yeah. Well, good old Google can't do it. And we'll just leave it at that. Phil was fascinated with the tale of Jonah, who was swallowed by a gigantic fish and then spat out upon the beach. So, Fomalhaut and Albemuth are both supposed to be whale's mouth. Close enough. You know, people say that Jonah was swallowed by a whale, but it was really a big fish. Anyway, that's what happens when you disobey God. I forget which city it was, but God told Jonah to go and warn the city, the pagan city, that they were about to be punished for worshiping idols. And Jonah didn't want to go, so he got on a ship to sail to Tarshish, which is probably Spain. And God brought up this great big storm, and when the sailors realized that it was because of Jonah, they tossed him overboard. A fish swallowed him, and then he was spat out upon the beach near the city. So all Jonah did was walk around the city 3 times, saying, "Yet 40 days." The people of the city knew what he meant, and they reformed, and they got rid of their idols and worshipped the one true God. And they were spared for a while. But Jonah didn't want to preach to them because they had killed his family. And God said, "No, you're going to go warn them." And he made sure that Jonah did go and warn them. But later they fell back into idolatry and God punished them. And their city was destroyed. I think that was Tyre, T-Y-R-E. I'm pretty sure it was. Alexander the Great, you know, he basically burned the city to the ground. And half of the city was on an island across the bay. And Alexander had his army build a bridge to the island so their chariots and horses could cross and take the other half of the city. Well, anyway, that's that story. Now, as far as the X goes, the second letter of exegesis is X, and the first sound, the first syllable is X. But it's more than that. Of course, nowadays we might think of the X-Files, the X-Factor, all kinds of things related to X. But what Phil thought of first was that we all know the story that Jesus was hanged on a cross. But as Phil insisted, that cross was not shaped like the letter T. That shape is very hard to set up. You have to dig a great big hole to put it in and, you know, really pack it in there or it just falls over. And, of course, it wasn't already set up in advance because they had Jesus carry his own cross to the hill at Golgotha, the Hill of Skulls. No, the cross had to be shaped like the letter X. Much easier to set up, easier to stay standing up, to keep it up. And most crosses in those times were shaped like the letter X. But there's even more to it. The story goes that Phil's visions began when he saw a fish symbol, supposedly for the first time. Well, that is not true. Phil had purchased a little bumper sticker at a local Christian bookstore, and that sticker had the fish sign. I just lost a listener. Good grief. Well, so he knew the fish sign. But he was groggy. He had just come from the oral surgeon where he had been put under anesthesia, you know, knocked out to have a bad tooth extracted. And we had his medication, his pain pills and antibiotics delivered by the pharmacy rather than stand around waiting for them with Phil in such a state, especially since we used a taxi cab to go there and come home. Well, the lady from the pharmacy brought the medication and Phil jumped out of bed where he'd been lying down and ran to the door before I could get there. And he, you know, she gave him his pills and he was actually looking down her blouse. And he realized that that was not a good thing to do. So he asked her, "What is that necklace?" And she said, "Oh, that's a fish sign. It's an early Christian symbol." And Phil pretended that he didn't know what it was. But we already had that window sticker. The word fish inside it, as did her necklace. So he knew also that there was this Greek word for fish inside the two curved lines of the fish symbol. I gotta do something real quick. Okay. The Greek word for fish is ichthys. I-C-H-T-U-Y-S in English, in our alphabet. The first letter, of course, is iota. You might call it iota. The second letter is what you might call chi or chi. I have to wet my whistle. It's actually chi, as in the German ach, or the Scottish loch, like Loch Ness. The Greeks wrote this ch as a single letter, x. Ichthys, fish. The little iota, the vowel, is tiny. The chi, the x, is huge. And that, folks, begins the X in exegesis. Cross is an X. The fish begins with an X. And by the way, when the Emperor Constantine, who eventually became the ruler of both the Eastern and Western Roman empires, combining them into one empire. Constantine won a battle at a bridge, and I'm sorry, I never remember the name of the bridge or the name of his opponent, the Western emperor. Well, Constantine was not doing well, and he had a dream in which he was told, in hoc signo vinces, in this sign you will be victorious, you will win, you will conquer. Now, traditionally, that sign is a cross, like the red cross on the flag of the Knights Templar. But it wasn't. Constantine actually used the symbol that we call Cairo, not the city in Egypt, the two Greek letters, he and pro. The chi, okay, is written as an X, and the rho looks like a letter P, as in Peter or Paul, and you take the X and you draw the P so that the loop is above the X and the straight line of the letter P goes down through the center of the X. The Cairo is Constantine's symbol in which he conquered and won the battle at the bridge. Christians didn't use the cross until quite recent times, and they have the wrong shape. The cross is supposed to be an X. Why the Cairo? The first two letters of Christ in Greek. Christ, the Greek word for Messiah, Hebrew Mashiach. So once again, Christ, Christos, begins with the letter X. Now, I'm writing the book with the working title, The X in Exegesis, but obviously I have a lot of research to do. But I will get it done sooner or later. But right now it's time for our second commercial break. We'll hear from a couple of our wonderful sponsors who make these programs possible. And then we'll hear about some of the other fascinating shows on Freedomizer Radio. So here we go.
Are you looking for a new place to shop, eat, and save? Are you sick of paying full price? Would you like to save money at the places you enjoy most? Well, here's a popular savings book that is full of coupons catered to your local area. It's called Save Around. This book is full of exclusive discounts to help you save money around your town. Yes, that's Save Around. You will save money at restaurants, department stores, cars, even flowers. When I take my family out, there are seven of us. The average meal was about $110 to $140. Last time I took them out, and I'm holding a copy of the receipt right here, the check originally was $120. With the Save Around book, our meal cost $82 at a place we go to quite often. Who knew? And there are a few places we found that we are going to check out. View the books in your area before you buy. Go to freedomizerradio.com or barefootislegal.org. Just click on your city, and within a few days, you will be saving money around town with your new Save Around book.
How would you like to make your work more enjoyable, be more creative and relaxed, all while sitting at your desk? That's exactly what my Serenity Rug has done for me. This revolutionary footrest, I can't even call it a footrest, because this thing encourages movement of your feet, which results in more blood flow. While traditional footrests advocate the motionless placement of your feet, I found that I'm unconsciously digging my feet into the long, soft grass strands of the Serenity Rug. It delivers an incredibly relaxing sensation that closely resembles the feeling of an exotic foot massage. If you have ever had a foot massage that made you want to stay there for hours, you know what I'm talking about. If you have not heard about the Serenity Rug, check them out at serenityrug.com and join the exclusive Serenity Rug community and enjoy a feeling of comfort and relaxation that most will never experience. They've sold out before, so I suggest you do your feet a favor and grab one of these. Again, that's serenityrug.com.
You never know when an emergency is going to happen. Whether stuck on the road, riding out a power outage, escaping a natural disaster, or surviving a doomsday apocalypse, what would you do? Disaster can strike at any time. Join your host, Nick Pierce, for Freedomizer's newest prepping and survival program, Are You Ready? Saturdays, noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific. Listen to Are You Ready? Here on Freedomizer Radio. And be prepared.
It's Sunday night. What are you planning to do? Watch an award show?
I want to thank the Academy for this opportunity to make a political statement that everybody's going to applaud me for because I'm a celebrity.
Watch a game, maybe?
I want to say I'm grateful for this win because now I can make a political statement that everybody's going to applaud me for because I'm a celebrity.
I've got it. How about a talk show?
I realize I haven't said anything funny all season, but hey, at least I can make a nightly political statement that everybody's going to applaud me for because I'm a celebrity.
Time for a change, isn't it? Tune in to Counterculture Wise Radio every Sunday night at 6 p.m. Pacific on freedomizerradio.com. Good news, great advice, and entertaining interviews you won't hear anywhere else. Counterculture Wise Radio. Radio with heart in mind.
Come join us as we peel away the layers of the unseen, unknown, and uncharted. And we hope you tune in late night, 9 p.m. Pacific time, to get ready to find a clarity after dark.
Greetings! Greetings and salutations, Freedomizer listeners! This is Maximilian von Riegelbeezer inviting you and yours to listen to me and mine! Join me, my sisters Abby and Fritzy, and my weekly guests, my father Jim and Mumsy Melanie, for Counterculture-Wise!
Max, it's not your show!
And we're not your guests, Max. We're the hosts. You may want to rein it in a little bit, buddy. Very well. Tune in for Counterculture-Wise every Sunday night at 6 p.m. on freedomizerradio.com. If you ask me, though, it should be called Counterculture Max.
Counterculture-Wise.
Radio with heart in mind.
Yes, folks, that was Max the Cat. They also have Dog Abby, your host, Melanie Hope, and co-host, Jim, coming up in about, less than 2 hours now. Now, I'm chasing daylight, so I'm going to have to cut this short, but I'll stay in for a little bit. The X in exegesis. Well, it really is a sort of an X-file. Phil flirted with Gnosticism and paganism, and he wrote and wrote and wrote what he called exegesis. Much of it is repetitive, and much of it wanders around, but it keeps coming back to this female voice that saved him, that told him he was good, he deserved to live, and he had a purpose in life. And he called her many names, but most often Sophia, at least in conversation, if not in his writing. You'll find Sylvia Sadassa, a character in Radio Free Albemuth, which has been made into a low-budget but very carefully crafted film, which you've just got to see. I think it's on Amazon Prime right now. It was on Netflix for a while. You can also buy it on DVD and Blu-ray. It doesn't have smashing special effects. Remember, low budget. But it tells a story. It's engaging. And it's faithful to the book, even though many changes were made. You have to make changes. Sorry, when you make a film, because certain things that are fine in a book just don't translate to a visual medium. But in this story, a satellite called Valis, now the film calls it Valis. Hi, kitty cat. There's a strange kitty cat around here. But Phil always called it Valis. But whatever you call it, it's this satellite in Earth orbit, kind of like the Dark Knight satellite that might be real. It's considered a conspiracy theory or something like that. Anyway, it's beaming information to people on Earth and helping them to fight the evil empire that has taken over, which is quite reminiscent of his Hugo Award-winning novel of 1963, The Man in the High Castle, which is now a mini-series on Amazon Prime, and it's coming to an end. The fourth season will be the last. And I think they're showing the fourth season now. Well, anyway, in The Man in the High Castle, the Nazis won World War II and they took over the United States with their ally Japan ruling on the West Coast, like, you know, California, and the Nazis, Germans, ruling on the East Coast, primarily New York. And this vast no man's land in between, kind of centered near Denver, Colorado. And in the novel, the no man's land is terribly dangerous. It's where the atomic bombs were dropped and, you know, the radiation could kill you. But in the miniseries, it's inhabited and they don't really dwell on that. So, anyway, in Valis, in the Valis books, the proper ones, Valis, Divine Invasion, and Radio Free Albemuth, this evil empire is ruling the whole world and we don't even know it. And this satellite in Earth orbit is beaming us information to help us fight off the empire and regain our freedom. And Phil actually had a brief experience of what he thought must be a satellite in Earth orbit with a mechanical voice on board speaking to him. He called it the AI voice, AI for artificial intelligence. Didn't sound like a human being talking, but more like a, at the time, you could call this phone number and hear a lady giving you the time of day. And it was more like that. Well, anyway, this voice was unable to tell Phil its location. It seemed like a woman's voice, but not organic. It was machine-like, as if someone had recorded individual syllables, and in order to form words, the computer would select the syllables it needed, so they didn't sound natural. Anyway, where the idea of the Valis satellite came from, but Valis also stands for God, more specifically Christ as God, or God as Christ. And sometimes people ask me, well, why doesn't God just wipe out the empire? Or in a more general setting, they'll ask Christians, why doesn't God wipe out evil? Does he like evil? Is God evil? Well, no. There's only one way to wipe out sin. There's only one way to wipe out evil, and that's to kill everybody. We all harbor some guilt, some sin, some evil. Although we, most normal people don't like evil, it kind of creeps into our lives. Like when I know I shouldn't eat that chocolate cake, I'll be sorry. Now, in my case, I won't get fat, but I might have trouble digesting it and become ill. I'm going to eat it anyway. I know I shouldn't. And as Jesus says somewhere in the New, in one of the Gospels at least, if you even were tempted to do something wrong, that counts. That's sin. If you lusted after another man's wife, Oh, you wanted to steal the money from someone else. That's all it takes, even though you didn't do it. It's our condition. Sin is not so much something you do as a condition, as if we had the flu. It's a virus that has infected us all. So, as I said, the only way God can wipe out evil is to kill everyone. And I don't think we want that. There are rules to this game. And I don't know why God doesn't just take us all to heaven to live with him, cleanse us and make us sinless so we can become spirits in the spiritual world. But he doesn't do it, so I don't know. It says there's two speakers. Does that mean that Let America Talk wants to talk? I can't tell this new... You have to type something if that's what you want, because I can't figure this out. Blog Talk has changed the studio so radically. Can't tell. Oh, I see. It's two people in the chat room. It's driving me crazy. Anyway, that's about it for this evening, and I do feel the need to explain. My cat, Blackie, is almost 20 years old. She went out this morning and has not come back inside. I fear that she's finally died. And I have to look for her, whether she's alive or dead. I need to find her. She can't have gone far. She's been in poor health. And I really have to go while there's still some daylight. If she has passed away, I need to bury her. If she hasn't, I need to bring her inside and keep her warm and safe. I couldn't keep her in the house. She never was an indoor cat until quite recently when her health began to decline. Oh, hi, Let America Talk. Thank you. That apparently is one of our hosts on freedomizerradio.com. Just remember, until further notice, you need to listen on Blog Talk because our website has gone down and we're moving to a new host. And that's a monumental task, and I'm glad that we have techies to do it for us. Meanwhile, I'm going to go on out with our favorite clip from our favorite author, Philip K. Dick. And I will catch you next week with, I don't know, something. We always do something. So hang in there and remember, on this day, he is risen. And thank you for listening.
The subject of this speech is a topic which has been discovered recently and which may not exist at all. I may be talking about something that does not exist. Therefore, I'm free to say everything or nothing. I, in my stories and novels, often write about counterfeit worlds, semi-real worlds, as well as deranged private worlds inhabited often by just one person, while meantime the other characters either remain in their own worlds throughout or are somehow drawn into one of the peculiar ones. This theme occurs in the corpus of my 27 years of writing. At no time did I have a theoretical or conscious explanation for my preoccupation with these pluriform pseudo-worlds, but now I think I understand. What I was sensing was the manifold of partially actualized realities lying tangent to what evidently is the most actualized one, the one which the majority of us, by consensus gentium, agree on. Later that day, back home again, but still deeply under the influence of the sodium pentothal, I had a short, acute flash of recovered memory. Then, in mid-March, a month later, the total body of memories, intact and entire, began to return. You are free to believe me or to disbelieve, but please take my word on it that I am not joking. This is very serious, a matter of importance. At that time, I had no idea what I was seeing. It resembled nothing that I had ever heard described. It resembled plasmic energy. It had colors. It moved fast. It collected and then dispersed. But what it was, what he was, I am not sure even now. In other words, it's a common theme in my writing that a dark-haired girl shows up at the door of the protagonist and tells him that his world is delusional, that there's something false about it. Well, this did finally happen to me. I even knew that her hair would be black. I had an actual complete sense of what she would look like and what she would say. She did appear. She was a total stranger, and she did inform me of this fact, that some of my fictional works were in a literal sense true. I wrote out these dreams in novel after novel, story after story. To name two in which this prior ugly present obtained most clearly, I cite The Man in the High Castle and my 1974 novel about the U.S. as a police state called Flow My Tears, The Policeman Said. I'm going to be very candid with you. I wrote both novels based on fragmentary residual memories of such a horrid slave state world. People claim to remember past lives. I claim to remember a different, very different present life. I know of no one who has ever made this claim before, but I rather suspect that my experience is not unique. What perhaps is unique is the fact that I am willing to talk about it. We are living in a computer-programmed reality, and the only clue we have to it is when some variable is changed and some alteration in our reality occurs. We would have the overwhelming impression that we were reliving the present, deja vu, perhaps in precisely the same way, hearing the same words, saying the same words. I submit that these impressions are valid and significant, and I will even say this: such an impression is a clue that at some past time point, a variable was changed, reprogrammed as it were, and that because of this, an alternative world branched off.